Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, issued a warning on Tuesday that health conditions are rapidly deteriorating in Sudan, where conflict has uprooted 4 million people. UNHCR warned that cholera and malaria outbreaks are expected in the coming months amid heavy rains, flooding, inadequate health facilities, and impeded humanitarian access. Highlighting particular concern for conditions in refugee camps and transit centres, the UN agency's William Spindler said that mental health services are virtually non-existent and medical supplies limited.
As many families have been on the move for weeks with very little food and medicine, rising malnutrition rates, disease outbreaks and related deaths continue to be observed.
In the White Nile state, Mr. Spindler said that the lack of medicine and medical staff is seriously hampering the delivery of services for over 144,000 newly displaced people across 10 refugee camps. After 3 months of conflict, the UN Health Agency reported a lack of medical supplies in places of active fighting. World Health Organization spokesperson Christian Lindmeier also condemned more than 50 attacks on healthcare facilities since conflict erupted between rival Sudanese militaries in April. UN humanitarians have said that the situation in Sudan is untenable as needs outweigh what can be delivered with available resources. To date, the Regional Refugee Response Appeal is only 29% funded. UN-appointed independent investigators said on Tuesday that they have gathered strong evidence of surging war crimes in Myanmar, including mass executions and sexual violence. The Independent Investigative Mechanism for Myanmar said that after reviewing over 20 million items, there is evidence that Myanmar's military and affiliated militia have been committing increasingly frequent and brazen war crimes. Head of the mechanism, Nicholas Kumejan, told reporters in Geneva that the violence and suffering in Myanmar has worsened.
The report makes note of increase in war crimes and crimes against humanity coming from aerial bombings of villages where civilians are present. Also, the execution of civilians and detained combatants when villages are taken, when people are captured and then executed, and also the intentional burning of homes and villages.
Highlighting in particular the evidence of sexual violence, Mr. Kumejan said that the failure to investigate crimes would be a crime in itself. The Myanmar monitoring mechanism was created by the United Nations Human Rights Council in 2018 to collect and analyze evidence of the most serious international crimes and other violations of international law committed in the country since 2011. The World Health Organization has issued an alert over a batch of contaminated common cold syrup available in India and beyond. Issuing a global alert for the cough syrup Coldout, the UN Health Agency said that a sample of the medication obtained in Iraq was found to be contaminated with toxins. WHO said that the stated manufacturer of the syrup is Forts Laboratories for Dabilai Pharma. According to the UN Health Agency, the medicine contained unsaged levels of contaminants diethylene glycol and ethylene glycol. WHO warned that toxic effects include vomiting, diarrhea, and acute kidney injury, with serious injury or death possible, especially among children. Caitlin Kelly, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
That's right, we're back on the air. Your lunchtime listening post. I'm your host, Mike Cadell.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think.
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh man, that is just wrong.
To survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
And when you begin to think of unbridled animal savagery, raw force of seeming to be nature, yet totally under the control control of mankind. Think of capitalism and irresponsibility, socially irresponsible capitalists. We're getting a firsthand experience of that here in Jefferson County. Well, we're in luck. I did get you your morning Democracy Now available. All the latest headlines, news dense to tip you off what's going on in the world outside. Coming up in the second hour,
Daniel Ellsberg at the gates of Lawrence Livermore Lab.
I was 14 when the book.
That's right. In the second hour, TUC Radio comes on, and with created by Maria Gallardin. And Daniel Ellsberg recently died from a terminal disease. He knew it was coming. And evidently, this is one of his few, well, he made a lot of public appearances right up to the end. And you can't give the guy, you got to give the guy credit, really. It is, that's some real courage. We're going to hear him from the gates, I think, of a nuclear bomb factory in the second hour on TUC Radio. Here's the headlines from today's Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major victory for reproductive rights and democracy, Ohio voters decisively rejected raising the threshold for passing constitutional amendments from a simple majority to 60%. The special election Tuesday, pushed by the Republican-led legislature and funded by an Illinois billionaire, came 3 months ahead of the November election in which voters will decide if the right to an abortion should be enshrined in the Ohio Constitution. The outcome of Tuesday's election means only half of voters need to cast ballots in favor of the pro-choice amendment. An AP poll found a majority of Ohio voters support the right to abortion. We'll speak with former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner after headlines. The Supreme Court has upheld the Biden administration's ability to regulate ghost guns, assembly kits which allow buyers to build untraceable guns at home. The federal government can require manufacturers of ghost gun kits include serial numbers and conduct background checks on customers while a challenge to the rule is heard in lower courts. Justices John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett joined with the three liberal members in the 5-4 ruling. In Sudan, deadly fighting shows no sign of slowing down nearly 4 months since the war between the military and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, broke out. Violence in Sudan's second most populous city, Omdurman, has escalated over control of a bridge crossing the Nile River used by the RSF to transport weapons. The healthcare system remains on the brink of collapse as medical facilities have been systematically targeted by fighters. The UN said Friday the conflict has left 24 million people, half of Sudan's population, in need of food and other aid, but only 2.5 million have been able to receive assistance. Over 4 million people have been internally and externally displaced, with the largest number of refugees crossing into Chad. Refugees from West Darfur deplored the desperate situation they were forced to flee.
The situation in Morni is tragic. There are problems, arrests and assault at night. The war is continuing, so we left. Whoever finds a way gets out, and whoever does not find it remains in suffering.
In Burma, a United Nations investigation has found the Burmese military is increasingly committing war crimes ranging from sexual violence to mass executions. The crimes also include the indiscriminate targeting of civilians with bombs, the burning of homes and buildings, and at times the destruction of entire villages. In April, at least 165 people, including children and babies, were killed after Burmese military jets rained fire and bombs on the village of Paziki. It was one of the deadliest attacks on civilians since the military junta seized power in a 2021 coup. Burmese armed forces claimed they were targeting terrorists. In Brazil, 8 South American leaders agreed to form an alliance to protect the Amazon as they met during a high-profile summit hosted in Belém by the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolivia, Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, Guyana, Peru, Suriname, and Venezuela signed on to a declaration which includes pledges to end deforestation, crack down on criminal activity in the Amazon, and lift up sustainable development. But the group stopped short of agreeing to a key indigenous demand for all countries to join in Brazil's pledge to end deforestation by 2030 and in Colombia's pledge to halt any new oil exploration. On Tuesday, indigenous groups took to the streets of Belém to voice their demands.
Because if there is no consent, we are not going to authorize public policies and every government to carry out extractivist, mining, or oil projects in forests and nature. We indigenous people say no to that. We, the indigenous people, say yes to life because the Amazon is where everything is.
Back in the United States in Atlanta, support is growing for a citywide referendum that could decide the future of Cop City, a massive multi-million-dollar police training complex that would be the largest in the country. The King Center, run by Bernice King, the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr., has joined Cop City opponents in calling on Atlanta officials to allow for a public vote on the project. The center criticized Atlanta leadership for ignoring the ardent community opposition against Cop City and the use of public funding. The campaign Vote to Stop Cop City is working to meet an August 14th deadline to collect 70,000 signatures from Atlanta voters to put a referendum on the November ballot to stop Cop City. This comes as civil rights and human rights organizations, including the ACLU and the NAACP, are urging the Homeland Security Department to investigate the mass targeting and surveillance of Cop City protesters, as dozens of forest defenders have been arrested and charged with domestic terrorism. The groups warn of, quote, dangers of vague, overbroad, and stigmatizing terms like domestic, violent, extremist, and militant to describe individuals who may be engaged in protected First Amendment activity, unquote. Meanwhile, an environmental group has sued the city of Atlanta as construction of Cop City has already contaminated local water streams. The lawsuit filed by the South River Watershed Alliance could temporarily block construction of Cop City. In Hawaii, officials issued an emergency proclamation as wildfires on the Big Island and Maui prompted evacuations and cut power to thousands of residents. 12 people were rescued from the water after jumping into the ocean to escape the smoke and fire. The fires have been driven in part by high winds from Hurricane Dora in the Pacific. In parts of Maui, 911 and phone lines are down. In Philadelphia, the slain dancer and choreographer O'Shea Sibley was laid to rest on Tuesday. A suspect has been charged with murder as a hate crime. He shouted racist and homophobic slurs at Sibley and his friends while they were dancing at a Brooklyn gas station last month. Sibley's loved ones paid tribute to the 28-year-old dancer at his funeral service held at Philadelphia's Met Opera House.
O'Shea had the power to touch everyone's heart. Whoever met him, O'Shea was a beacon of light for a lot of us in our community that was engulfed in darkness. But O'Shea rejoiced. O'Shea was O'Shea.
The video conferencing software Zoom has come under fire after it changed its user policy, opening the door for the company to use consumer data to train its AI system. Zoom responded to the backlash Monday by denying the company would use video or chat content for AI training without consent. But digital rights advocates say Zoom could still take the data for other purposes and that users may not easily be able to opt out of AI use if a call host chooses to allow it or is not aware of it. In 2020, Democrats called for the FTC to look into Zoom's privacy policies, accusing it of misleading customers on the security of its encryption. In related news, Zoom, an early hallmark of pandemic-era remote work, is facing backlash from employees after announcing it'll require workers within a 50-mile radius of its offices to return to on-site work 2 days per week. And in California, thousands of Los Angeles City workers walked off the job for 24 hours Tuesday in the first such strike in 40 years to protest repeated labor law violations by their employers. This is city worker Alfonso Williams.
We all do a wonderful job. We're all needed. We're all either, we're essential workers out here. And we worked through the pandemic. We were out here. We never wavered. And so just bargain in good faith. And that's all we're asking. And when you don't bargain in good faith, this is what happens.
The one-day work stoppage comes as Hollywood writers and actors remain on strike and as Los Angeles hotel workers have staged periodic walkouts after their contract expired at the end of June. The Hotel Workers Union, Unite Here, filed a labor complaint this week, citing a number of violent retaliatory incidents at picket lines perpetrated by hotel security guards. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That's right, democracynow.org. Check it out. And coming up, Alex Smith, who has produced for years, support those who support Radio Free Kansas. Alex Smith has produced for years and created one of the largest environmental websites from climate change science. You can disbelieve and act like it doesn't exist, but do your research. Go to ecoshock.org and explore the massive website featuring the Radio EcoShock broadcasts, one of the largest when it comes to scientific understanding of climate change. And now, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for real disaster news? If the warming currents in the North Atlantic weaken or collapse, Ireland, England, and North Europe will become stormy and cold, even as the world warms. Northern forests and agriculture around the world would suffer. A collapse of the ocean system known as AMOC has happened before. A new study suggests that destabilization could come again soon, even in this decade.
Now, we don't know if tomorrow is scheduled, so we want to be sure that we have enough money to enjoy our lifestyle today.
Look, there's been a lot of sensational, overblown reporting about an AMOC collapse, starting with the science fiction movie The Day After Tomorrow. It's not like that. In a few minutes, you will hear directly from an author of that study in Nature Communications, Professor Suzanne Ditlevson. All this comes in a time of unprecedented climate chaos. Extreme super events are piling on, popping up around the world in the same week. Slovenia was just wrecked by an extreme rain, with floods expected to pour into Croatia. As I record this, the UK is bracing for a life-threatening storm system. 3 months' worth of rain fell on northern China in 40 hours, flooding Beijing as never before. That was just a blip in the news, but it will take years to recover. Iranians are used to high heat, but the whole country was ordered to shut down for 2 days to save lives during an extreme heat event. In South Korea, 600 scouts needed medical treatment for heat exhaustion. Japan was lashed with record heat and dangerous storms at the same time. Almost unreported, there was a winter heat wave in South America. Temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 C, were reported in Chile, some records reaching right up into the high Andes. For perspective, the start of August in the southern hemisphere is like the beginning of February in the north. It should be cold. High heat has never come this early in their season. The weather has gone insane. But don't think an ocean circulation collapse could be a good thing for the UK, Europe, or anywhere else. A bit later, I will examine sources explaining the impacts. Right now, let's get to the news about when the North Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, could change to a state not seen on Earth for at least 12,000 years.
Radio EcoShock.
If the warming currents in the North Atlantic weaken or collapse, Ireland, England, and Northern Europe would become harder places to live. Northern forests around the world could change as the impacts ripple out globally. A collapse of the ocean system known as AMOC has happened before. and now scientists worry that destabilization could come again soon. On July 25th, the journal Nature Communications published a paper called Warning of a Forthcoming Collapse of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. The authors are Peter and Suzanne Ditlefsen. Co-author Suzanne is professor of mathematics at the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. From Copenhagen, Suzanne Ditlefsen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Just one correction. I am from Institute of Mathematical Sciences at University of Copenhagen. It's my brother Peter that's from the Niels Bohr Institute.
Okay, I'm glad we got that straightened out. Suppose the impacts of global warming break down that key system called AMOC. What might that mean in general terms for listeners in Ireland, the UK, and Northern Europe, and maybe even your own Denmark?
Well, it will mean that it will become colder in our area because this is a current system that exchanges heat from the tropical areas up towards the north along the west coast of Europe and makes that more warmer. And if that one breaks down, we suppose that it will become colder. We suppose that there will be globally much more wild weather. It will be more stormy. Probably the precipitation patterns will change. So places where there were before a lot of precipitation might be have much less and might be have dry out. I just have to say that our paper actually does not deal with what happens after the breakdown. So our paper is about what happens up to the breakdown and estimation of this possible collapse of the AMOC. And also, it's quite difficult actually to know what will happen if the AMOC collapses because we don't really have any data that can tell us exactly what will happen. So we have to rely on models and we have to rely on simulation of these models. So this AMOC has two stable states, or it's believed to have two quasi-stationary states, statistically stable states, an off state and an off. This on state we have had for more than 12,000 years. So everything that we know from modern times after we had agriculture and civilizations and building larger cities, etc., that is with the climate more or less as we have today with this on mode. And the off mode, where we no longer have this exchange of heat that will heat up the tropical areas and it will cool down in the North Atlantic regions. And this does not happen in the Pacific Ocean. And this is because in the Pacific Ocean, there is not such a pump. There's some currents still. But Alaska and Canada is much colder than Western Europe, even though if we should have more or less the same climate for the altitude. However, exactly because of this AMOC, we have this more warm weather that we might lose if the AMOC collapses.
A key problem you address in your new paper, AMOC currents have only been measured accurately since about 2004. We have barely 20 years of records in a system we think can change radically. How did you approach this uncertainty?
Well, that uncertainty was really difficult to deal with because, of course, you can never do better predictions or better models that you have data for. So the data will kind of decide the quality of your prediction. However, 20 years of data is not enough to really make a statistical analysis of such complicated long-term system. So we can see since 2004 that it seems to have weakened. However, there is no way with such a short time series to really judge whether this weakening is just natural fluctuations or might it be due to climate changes. So what we did instead was to look for historical data that do not have the same quality because we didn't have ways of measuring back in time. So they don't have the same quality, but they are thought of being fingerprints of the AMOC. So what we're using is in an area that's called the subtropical gyre, which is south and east of Greenland. And this is thought to be a fingerprint of the AMOC, the surface temperature. Why is that? That is because this exchange of water, where warm water flows northwards in the surface, and then around this area, it will cool down, and it is salty and colder, and that is warmer water, and the warmer water will sink down, and that is actually what's maintaining the pump. So it sinks down, and then it travels back at a couple of kilometers of depth in the ocean. Now, if you imagine that this pump stops or it becomes weaker, that means that less water, warm water, is brought up towards this subpolar gyre. And that means that a decrease in temperature could be a weakening of this AMOC. However, it's not that simple, because on top of that, we have global warming. And global warming is even amplified in the Arctic. So it's even worse than the general global warming in that area. So what we did was correcting for the global warming by subtracting. And we did a slightly different subtraction than what has been done before in these fingerprints. And that's because of this amplification. So normally you would subtract one time, and we actually subtracted twice the global warming. And then that means now that we have historical data from 150 years back. So we start actually already in 1870, and then we have monthly data of this, let's call it the AMOC fingerprint. Now that means that we have data from before industrial times. So we have from a time before global warming started, and we can make an analysis where we can understand what the distribution under natural circumstances should be. So that is kind of our baseline. So we have a baseline of what we believe the AMOC in a healthy state should be. And then we can look at how that changes. And this is called early warning signals. So let me explain. When this AMOC loses its strength, then the variance increases. The variance is the variability. And that is because this system has what we call a tipping point. This AMOC is a highly nonlinear system, and it has these two, it's believed to have these two stable states. And it can suddenly switch from one state to another. And once it's switched from one state to the other, to the off mode, it will not be irreversible, but it will be irreversible in a time scale of a lifetime, let's say. So that means that basically we cannot go back. So you push the system a little bit, and you might be able to retract a little bit your pushing. So say you have global warming, and the global warming makes the ice sheet in Greenland melt. And when that melts, it brings more fresh water into the ocean, into this subpolar gyre. And that means the water becomes less salty, so that is, and then it does not sink. So this is kind of the driver of weakening the AMOC. But that is caused by global warming. So we can go push a little bit with the global warming. So and it can still kind of react and come back to a healthy state. But if we push too much, it will kind of pass the state and go to the other state. And then even if we retract a little bit, we are not able to go back. So this is a tipping point. It's not a linear change. So we are scared of passing this tipping point, because then that is what we call the collapse of the AMOC.
We've covered quite a bit there. Now, it's interesting that you raise the issue of the pump that is really part of the great global conveyor belt of ocean water that circles around the world, because in April, I talked with Dr. Matthew England from the Center for Antarctic Science in Sydney, and his paper warned a decline of ocean overturning in Antarctica is already taking place and could change state within a single lifetime. And so it's my understanding that Antarctic overturning is also a major driver of the conveyor belt that goes all the way up to the North Atlantic Exchange. And I worry that European scientists and certainly journalists have not really looked at the connections between the southern pump in Antarctica and the northern pump that we're talking about in AMOC.
That sounds very interesting. We haven't looked at that either, but that sounds very interesting, and that might very well be. So what we did was something new that has not really been done in this way before, and I think that is why we get an earlier, let's say, prediction for when it possibly might collapse. I mean, I think it's very interesting that you say there in the south that it might actually collapse within a lifetime, because that has been thought that that would not happen to the AMOC, that it's the IPCC has predicted that a collapse is highly unlikely to happen in this century. And that means that we are at odds. The prediction that Peter and I did is at odds with this prediction because it's much earlier that we have. But the difference in what we are doing is that we look at it from a database. So we look at the data and see what that does. So the IPCC reports, they are based on models, on huge, very detailed climate models with all the mechanisms that we know are there. But also because they are so big, they contain a lot of variables, they contain a lot of parameters, and just slight imprecisions in that might actually change. That is the first thing that is problematic with the models. So I like the models very much, and I also trust very much the IPCC report. So that is not our point. The point is that the models are able to answer certain questions, but there are other questions they might not be able to answer. We believe, or Peter and I, we believe that these models that are the basis of the IPCC report are slightly too conservative. They are built upon what we know from the climate for the last 100 years. So they might not have enough nonlinearity to actually capture what is happening to the AMOC. We don't know, but that is something we have been discussing a lot, Peter and I, why it is that our predictions come so much earlier than the IPCC. And that is one of the ideas that maybe that is why they are simply not nonlinear enough. So we took a completely different approach looking at the data. And what happens when you have such a tipping point is the following. When you approach the tipping point, the system loses what is called resilience, and it has this critical slowing down. So loss of resilience means that it's not really able to come back to a healthy state if it is perturbed. So you can kind of compare it with, if you imagine a healthy person, you have 37 Celsius degrees in the body, and if you get too warm, you sweat, and if you get too cold, you burn sugar, and in that way, you maintain your temperature. But now imagine when you get sick, then suddenly you get fever, the temperature starts to fluctuate much more. There's much more variability. There's much more variance. You're not able to maintain the temperature at where it should be. It's a little bit the same that we are looking at in this tipping point that we are approaching or that we are moving towards. Then the variance increases. The system is not able to recover as fast as it was earlier. And this is exactly what we are looking at. So we are looking not at the mean value or at the level. So we do see a weakening, but that weakening could be because of just natural fluctuations. And we don't know what the level is for a possible collapse. So instead, we look at these signs that is called early warning signals. We look at these signs that appear when you are approaching such a tipping point, also called a bifurcation. To be technical, it's a saddle mode bifurcation. So we have this increase of variance and also increase of something called autocorrelation. So we looked at that, and then we realized the following. When you have such a tipping point, this type of tipping point, I mean, we believe that it's a saddle mode bifurcation. Of course, we might also be wrong that the system is actually not governed by a saddle mode bifurcation, but there are many people, not everyone, but there are many people that think that that is the case. So when you have such a saddle mode bifurcation, it's universal. So what do I mean by universal? I mean that any system that has such a bifurcation, whatever the system is, it could be in economics, it could be in climate, it could be in ecology, it could be in physiology, all the details are different. But when you come to the tipping or to the stratification point, they're all the same. It's universal. And we use this universal way of behavior of the system to recognize whether it is moving towards this tipping point and also when that tipping point in that case would happen. So maybe it sounds a little bit like magic, and also actually in the beginning when we started having these ideas, we thought it was kind of magic, but you can think about it like in a phase transition. You can have a phase transition of elements. So, for example, water going from ice to liquid water. So that's a phase transition. But every element do the same. So you can have mercury or glass or even stone. They have all the details different, and they do it all at different temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. But the phase transition itself, when it melts, it's the same for all of them.
I should clarify for listeners, you've been talking about bifurcation, which is not a word many people use, and it generally means to split into two. So we're sort of talking about coming to a fork in the road in the behavior of this large Atlantic system, which has been in one state now but could go to another. But in a new paper, and I think you've been talking about this, it's not yet published, Johannes Lohmann and colleagues propose that there are intermediate steps and early warning steps, as you say. But even those intermediate steps, he says, are also abrupt. So we could go down in steps, or could it collapse to a new low state precipitously? Do we know?
Well, from our study, we cannot see it. So the only thing we can see is that there is a tipping point. And whether that we can say nothing about what is on the other side of the tipping point. I'm convinced that it will be something abrupt, but whether it will be in steps, so how abrupt it will be, how big a step, we cannot say anything about that. So our method does not work for that. So there's no way we can use this method to say this. And I know there are lots of discussion of what will actually happen. There are some paleoclimatic records from the ice ages. It seems like there were two states of the AMOC, the on and the off mode, but of course, that was during the ice ages, and we have a completely different climate now. So I would say we don't know whether there are intermediate steps also. So we cannot say that. We cannot.
Suzanne Ditlevsen, you're not a climate scientist per se, but a respected professor of mathematics. How did you get drawn into this contentious question of what will happen to the North Atlantic currents?
Well, really true. I am not a climate scientist, and I hope I didn't say anything wrong. My brother is a climate scientist, so that's Peter, that's the co-author of the paper. And this came about because we often have many scientific discussions, and you know, even when we just having fun, we're having scientific discussions. And this came about because Peter is leading this big center of tipping points, TPIS, it's called, the tipping points in the Earth system. And he has been working with these early warning signals and trying to not only detect that there are early warning signals, which other people also have done, but he was bothered by the fact that there was not really statistical significance or evaluation of the statistical significance to the results. And secondly, he also got this very simple idea in a very ad hoc way to extrapolate from these early warning signals towards when the tipping point can be expected. He therefore contacted me, and we started to discuss it with me because I'm a professor of statistics, and I understand all the statistics, and I can say something about whether we can trust results or not. And then we just started working together and discussing and finding out how to do this, because So in our paper we present kind of two methods how to do it. So there's this simple, intuitively easy to understand method where we use the variance in itself. So we use the moment and simply predict when it becomes infinity. That can also be good. The problem is that estimator, so now it also becomes a little technical. The estimator, when we do that, is actually not very well behaved. It actually has infinite variance. So an estimator is a random variable, and this random variable has a variance. And you would normally want that variance to be as small as possible, because that means that the estimate that you get is more precise. But that way he did it actually led to an estimator with infinite variance. So I really chewed on the problem, and we found another way of doing it that was more robust, more statistically sound. It's a little more complicated, a little less intuitive what's going on. But the beauty of it was actually that when we estimated first with this, let me call it the moment method, we got this very early prediction of the most likely time in 2057. Of course, we should not take that year as very serious. It's just around there. There's lots of uncertainty here. So around 2057. And actually, we started this whole work in order to confirm what the IPCC reports present. We wanted to confirm that. And then it was like, that's too early. That's far too early. How can that be? And this was where we really thought there must be something wrong with this moment method, and we worked hard on it. Then when we actually developed this using tools from maximum likelihood estimation and stochastic processes, it turned out that we got the same estimate. Of course, with a lot of uncertainty. And that made us more, it made us more scared, because it's an earlier estimate, but it also made us believe more in our estimate. This is why we actually now believe that we're not way off.
And so you found that this could happen, this big change in the Atlantic currents could happen around mid-century. That's maybe the most probable. But there's a wide range of uncertainty, as you say, because, well, for one thing, the world is warming, and the Arctic is warming even faster than that, all sorts of factors. But your range of possibilities went from as early as 2025, which is just 2 years from now, all the way up to 2095. So somewhere in that period. But I think the media kind of leapt on it and went, well, hey, this could happen this decade even. Do you think that is possible, or is that just a rare possibility?
That's a rare possibility. Of course, it's possible, but it's a rare possibility. So this is the thing about it. We were giving a 95% confidence interval, what we call it. So it's saying that is where, given the data and given the model, so there are more uncertainties, and these uncertainties are very difficult to quantify. Given that, we give this 95% confidence interval, but there's not the same probability for any point in that confidence interval. So the big chunk of probability lies around mid-century, so around, let's say, 2060, from 2040 to 2080 or something like that. That's where we believe it would happen, given that we continue the way we do. So what we call it is business as usual scenario. And the business as usual scenario is that we continue increasing greenhouse gas emissions at the same speed as we do now. So, of course, if serious measures are being taken, and at least that seems like what many governments around the world and people are really trying to do, and we reduce it, then we do not believe in our own estimate. So it is kind of business as usual, which corresponds to the worst scenario of the IPCC prediction. So that is kind of comforting if we believe that we can actually change how we act so that global warming can be diminished. Then these estimates will be different.
In the real world, as we wrap up here, in our daily lives, what should listeners take away from your new work and the whole fear of a big change in the North Atlantic?
I think the first take-home message is that this could happen much earlier than we thought. And I think this is one part of the climate, and this is a very important part. But, of course, there are a lot of other problems with global warming, and we have seen that this summer with all the extreme heats and fires and stuff like that. So that has nothing to do with the AMR, but that has to do with global warming. So I think the first take-home message is yet another argument for this is serious now. We have to stop greenhouse gas emissions now. So it's kind of, I wouldn't say wake-up call, because these wake-up calls have been again and again. I mean, it's all over. But I really hope that this can be yet another serious message that we have to change. I don't want to use fear in people. I don't think that is a good thing. I mean, we also need to act, and if we are too scared, we cannot act. And, of course, we have to do it on all levels. So I really believe that we cannot really have serious reductions unless governments, especially in the big countries, that they actually do something. But I think we should do something at all levels, also on a personal level, and for various reasons. First of all, because from a psychological point of view, I think it can help us to do something, to feel that we do something for this. Secondly, I think that if we want to put pressure on the politicians, I mean, the politicians are just, I mean, they are just a product of who we elect. I mean, they cannot do anything if they don't have votes. So if they feel a pressure from people, that will also bring a political change, I think. And from that point of view, I think it's very important that we also do something on a personal level. So I do think that we have come to a time in this climate crisis that we have that we really have to act on all levels, on the personal level, on the political level, on the industrial level. I must say, I have actually recently have become quite optimistic about certain things. We have had in Denmark, we've had some meetings between scientists and in industry. And what struck me was that there are lots of big players in the industry that are really doing huge measures to change, even doing more things that were being done in a governmental level. Of course, you need to be a big player because small companies might not be able to have the economic freedom to do so. But it made me feel more optimistic to see that there are really companies are moving faster than governments now. And maybe that will also make a change.
I'm not so optimistic in other countries. As I see, for example, the government of the UK is now opening up all sorts of the North Sea for more oil and gas drilling, saying that they want to max out production there. So it's a seesaw battle, Suzanne. We're making some progress in some places and then losing in others. From the University of Copenhagen, we've been speaking with Professor Suzanne Ditlevsen, co-author of the new paper, Warning of a Forthcoming Collapse of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. You can find links to follow up in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Suzanne, thank you for helping us understand this hidden work of the ocean.
I've been happy to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What will happen when AMOC collapses? As you heard from Suzanne Ditlevsen, it is difficult to predict what will happen if it changes to a very weak state and moves southward. We cannot rely on data from previous AMOC shifts during the ice ages because humans are now warming the world at a never-before-seen pace. All of this combines into something very different and very new. That is not good news for an ecological system that depends on certain conditions on land and in the sea. Let's take the UK, for example. If you just look at IPCC projections and other models, it looks like the UK would be a good place to survive global warming, at least in the first century. By 2080, southern Britain would be hotter and likely experience periodic droughts. Scotland would be warmer, but that might feel good. The Scottish Highlands would get wetter. As James Lovelock pointed out, the sea around the UK would help protect it from temperature extremes that develop over land masses like Russia and China and North America. Lovely. But if the AMOC shuts down, things don't go so well. Many sources suggest the average UK temperatures would drop by 3.4 degrees C, about 6 degrees Fahrenheit. Other experts suggest it could be even colder, up to 5 degrees C, average temperature drop. A 2021 report by the OECD says Europe and North America would experience a drop of 3 degrees to 8 degrees C and 1 degree to 3 degrees C, respectively. So that's 3 to 8 in Europe and 1 to 3 drop in North America. In the southern hemisphere, there is little predicted temperature change, but strong disruptions to precipitation patterns in the tropics. Winter would be much colder in northern Europe. We can barely imagine that, while the rest of the world suffers through long-lasting heat waves. But wait a minute. It could be the rain, not the cold. The real blow for the UK after AMOC collapse may not be temperature, but changing rain. Dr. Paul Ritchie and his co-authors studied this for their 2020 paper called Shifts in National Land Use and Food Production in Great Britain After a Climate Tipping Point. They say, quote, "We show that economic and land use impacts of such a tipping point are likely to include widespread cessation of arable farming, with losses of agricultural output that are an order of magnitude larger than the impacts of climate change without an AMOC collapse," end quote. In fact, Ritchie and his colleagues found that the amount of arable land in the UK would drop from the current 42% to around 7%. That is disaster, and an end to any dreams of the UK having the security of its own food. The authors say that 7% number could be boosted higher, we don't know how much higher, by irrigation, but there are limits to the amount of irrigation water available. So the AMOC collapse is as much about changes in precipitation as temperature. The media leaves this out. One major institution took a stab at predicting impacts of an AMOC collapse. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, is composed of 37 democracies. In 2021, the OECD published a report called Climate Tipping Points. That study found rainfall over Siberia would fall so low that boreal forests would convert to savanna grasslands or bush. Meanwhile, the extra water vapor in the atmosphere due to heating would fall heavily on the Canadian boreal forest. Scientists worry the AMOC collapse impacts on precipitation patterns could change water distribution in the atmosphere over the whole planet. For example, after AMOC collapse, the speed of Amazon conversion from forests that are full of carbon to grass and shrubs might go faster. The memory in human civilization, it's only so long, it's never experienced this new state of the ocean. We just don't know what could happen. The OECD report says, quote, "In addition, this work further identifies the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets as initiators of tipping cascades and the AMOC as the mediator transmitting cascades," end quote. But the AMOC collapse can be a disaster for monsoons and food in the tropics as well. Let's look at this. The OED says, quote, "Monsoon systems are also likely to be affected by a potential collapse or slowdown of the AMOC. Analysis by the OECD in 2021 finds that West Africa will experience the largest decrease in rainfall on the planet under global warming scenarios. The shutdown of the AMOC will exacerbate this effect, disrupting the African monsoon and leading to a further reduction in precipitation that can in turn cause widespread drought over much of the region. A collapse of the AMOC would also lead to the weakening of the Indian summer monsoon, which could lead to more frequent droughts with potentially detrimental impacts on Indian farmers' rice harvest," end quote from OECD. Here is a clip from a presentation by the German oceanographer Stefan Ramsdorf, who I really admire. It was recorded at the University of Exeter in November 2022.
And it turns out that that cooling area south of Greenland is, of course, part of the slowdown of the Atlantic overturning, but also the excessive warming along the American coast, inshore of the Gulf Stream, is a result of a slowdown of the overturning circulation. There is some fluid dynamics behind this, which is going too far to explain here, but it's well established theoretically. Now, my PhD student, Levke Cesar, back then has spent a couple of years compiling observations of sea surface temperature, and this graph here shows the trend since the year 1900. And you can see this peculiar fingerprint pattern with the cold blob south of Greenland and that warming along the American coast. It's just fuzzy because we don't have ocean observations everywhere at all times, obviously, so it can't be shown in as high a resolution, but I think you will agree that the pattern agrees, and we know it's a fingerprint of an AMOC slowdown. And when we calibrated this with the help of the model, we find that this corresponds to about 15% weakening of that overturning circulation, mostly since about 1950. We can also look further back in time using proxy data from sediment cores and ice cores, etc. And recently we compiled, last year actually, a paper showing the reconstructions by paleoclimate studies in the published literature for the AMOC. And this shows the last 1,500 years or so, if you look at the left column there. And you can see that mostly the AMOC has been stable until the 20th century. It shows an unprecedented decline. And so that's why we concluded that the Atlantic overturning is at its weakest in the last millennium. And a couple of weeks ago, I was at the International Conference on Paleoceanography, where I saw some as yet unpublished proxy data saying this going back even much further in time, and it's probably at its weakest since the entire Holocene by now. Now, the AMOC is weakening, but we also know already since 1961, since the work of Henry Stommel, that it has a tipping point. It's very well established by now. As a postdoc in the 90s, I showed this behavior in a 3D ocean GCM, and the circulation is sensitive to adding fresh water because it inhibits the sinking by making the water less dense. And so if you add fresh water like melting Greenland ice or increased rainfall, you move on towards the right in this diagram from the present climate point, and eventually you hit a cliff there where there is no more stable state, and it falls into to the bottom of the diagram into a completely different new collapsed state. So just to sum up my key points here, the conclusions are that the AMOC is weakening. Personally, I think there's very strong evidence for that now that it's unprecedented in at least a millennium. We know that the AMOC has a tipping point, very well-established physics, the positive feedback, salt advection is understood. But the big uncertainty is how far away is this tipping point? And recent studies have unfortunately shown maybe too close for comfort.
Recently, Ramsdorf says he had to revise his thinking on how soon an AMOC state change could arrive. Along with the IPCC, he had been thinking the collapse is very unlikely to arrive during this century. But due to at least three new studies, Ramsdorf changed his mind. He now agrees that, on our current high emissions path, this vital ocean circulation system could fall apart during the next decades. He revised his position post at realclimate.org. Find that link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Here he addresses the new paper on the BBC, July 26, 2023.
This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour Live from the BBC. Now, the Atlantic Ocean system that brings warm water from the tropics into the North Atlantic could collapse much sooner than previously predicted. That's according to a study by Danish scientists just published in the journal Nature Communications. Their new analysis estimates a timescale for the collapse between 2025 and 2095, with a central estimate of 2050 if global carbon emissions are not reduced. We're talking about something called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC for short, and it's known to have a huge effect on the climate in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, full disclosure on this, there is some controversy around this particular report, because although most climate scientists do warn of a potential tipping point or collapse of the AMOC system, there is a disagreement over when it could happen. It's important, this, because when it happens, the impact could obviously potentially be very damaging for humans. So let's try and get some clarity.
A tipping point generally is a point where a system will develop into a very different state without being pushed further. It's the point from where it happens by itself, like if you push your coffee cup towards the edge of the desk, and then there's a tipping point from then onwards, you don't have to push anymore. Something really changes, it crashes down. With the AMOC, it would wind down in a matter of decades, probably, once the tipping point is passed, and that would have major impacts on the surface temperature, first of all. Regions, I mean, it's already slowing down, and that already has a big impact because that region to the west of Great Britain, the British Isles, is the only part of the world that has actually cooled in the last 100 years, while the rest of the planet has warmed. That's what we call the cold blob. If the AMOC really winds down altogether, that would expand and actually cover Britain, Iceland, Scandinavia, which then could cool down in the midst of a much warmer world. But there would be many other consequences for extra sea level rise, marine ecosystems being really threatened, CO2 uptake by the ocean declining, and so on.
Okay, I mean, the sort of frightening element of this is that when you talk about cooling, potentially that cooling could be very much lower, couldn't it? I mean, some people talk about something similar to what happened in the Ice Age. Is that true?
It is actually quite exaggerated because we are in a world with elevated carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere now. So those very cold numbers, they come from experiments where in pre-industrial climate, you close down the AMOC. If you do it in an already much warmer world, it won't get that cold. But the key thing is that, you know, you get cold patch surrounding by exceptionally warm regions of the Earth that changes really the whole dynamics of the weather systems. There will probably be a lot more storms hitting the UK and so on.
Right. The UN's climate change body, the IPCC, says it's very unlikely to happen this century. What's your view on that? Is that still the thinking?
That was my view until a few years ago, but you have to know that in the IPCC jargon, very unlikely means less than 10%. And we are talking about a planetary scale disaster that we really want to avoid at 99.9% certainty. So even saying there is up to 10% risk for this is, in my view, really scary. But now we can say the IPCC conclusion resulted on climate models, doing, you know, the standard models, making projections for the future. And there, in most cases, the AMOC does not collapse in this century. But there is mounting evidence, and it has been actually for quite a while, that these models have an AMOC that is far too stable compared to what we can conclude from observational data. And these new studies, there are at least three studies now, the new one is the third, have used observational data to look for precursors of a potential tipping point. And these studies come to the conclusion that it is actually probably much closer, probably in this century, but still with a big uncertainty attached to that.
The key point of all of this, though, is that the tipping point is, as you've explained, the point where you can't go backwards. It's just going to happen no matter what you do.
That's right, and we should really minimize that risk. I think it's a very serious risk.
Professor Stephen Rahmstorf speaking to us earlier.
It's time to sort out the facts from the myths about AMOC. First of all, as Sabine Hossfelder says in her YouTube video, the Gulf Stream is not going to stop.
When the overturning circulation stops, then the Gulf Stream will no longer get this extra push to the north. This would mean that Europe will cool down. Simulations with climate models have shown that the average temperatures in Europe could go down by as much as 5 degrees. So that's the thing that everyone is worried about, that the AMOC will stop. However, this would not mean that the Gulf Stream will stop. The Gulf Stream is caused by the rotation of the Earth. The only way to stop the Gulf Stream is quite literally to stop the Earth from turning.
With that out of the way, we must also look at the fact that AMOC is not the Gulf Stream, and vice versa. This comes from a massive confusion about names and how the system works. Because so many people have heard of the Gulf Stream, the media and a few scientists talk as though the Gulf Stream and AMOC are the same thing. they are not. But it is not easy to say what they are. I mean, people in Scotland are still calling the Atlantic Current the Gulf Stream, even though the Gulf Stream technically ends when it mixes into the northern waters around Labrador and up the sides of Greenland. As I understand it, the Gulf Stream does operate to move heat and water from the tropics to the pole. No doubt it is part of the global ocean system called the Great Conveyor Belt. Now look, when you sail east from the United States, I'm a sailing fan, say from Virginia heading toward the Caribbean, not far out to sea it is difficult to sail south. Ships encounter a steady flow of water running up to 5 nautical miles per hour going north. In a small boat that only goes 5 knots, you would stay in the same place with the engine running full power. Eventually, further east, you are out of the Gulf Stream, and you can more easily sail south. The AMOC is not one current like that, not something you can identify. It is a distributed system with a lot of different subcurrents curling around in the ocean, but it has a known general direction to the overall flow. But AMOC is more than just a flow of water. Being an overturning circulation, ocean water becomes heavier with salt in the north and sinks to the bottom. From there it flows in a countercurrent around 2,000 meters down, say 6,000 feet below the surface. That cold bottom water goes all the way down to Antarctica. AMOC is part of the pump that keeps seawater circulating between the poles. So that is AMOC myth number one. It is not the same as the Gulf Stream. While AMOC can shift to a very weak state, called an off state by experts, the Gulf Stream is driven by other factors, including the rotation of the Earth, and will not stop even during rapid climate change. At least, that's what we think so far. Number two, Europe will not experience another ice age in 2 years. For crying out loud, people get a lot of clicks, YouTube views, and re-exes, I guess that's what you call it now, by picking the worst possible outcome and exaggerating that. The UK may get bad winter storms, like the amazing snow dump of 1952. Look that one up. But again, snowstorms point to warmer weather, not extreme cold. When the air is really cold, like minus 30 or 40 on either temperature scale, that cannot hold much water vapor. Heavy snow is less likely during extreme cold. Every northern Canadian grew up with the phrase, "It's too cold to snow." Real temperature is what matters. In a generally warming world, the worst predicted is around 5 degrees C average cooling in the UK, with 2 or 3 degrees cooling more likely. The coldest days would be colder. Leaving changes in precipitation aside, just that much cooling will rearrange wild plant and animal survival in the United Kingdom and Ireland, and the instability could wipe out crops in some seasons. A lot of buildings in the UK are just not ready for a colder climate, being poorly insulated. Energy bills would go up, driving even more warming in the rest of the world. Stefan Ramsdorf suggests after the AMOC tipping point is passed, and we don't know exactly when that will be, it might take 2 or 3 decades to fully extend the impact to cool the UK and North Europe as much as it can, not to mention the harsh impacts on coastal Norway. But then, perhaps a century or two later, continued warming of the planet, if that happens, would overcome the AMOC collapse cooling. Dear old London would begin to warm again, long after the country has been completely rearranged by the ocean current collapse. Nobody with any expertise in climate science believes the UK will become anything like the Ice Age. Manchester will not be covered by a glacier a mile thick. Myth number three, is AMOC or the Gulf Stream keeping the UK and Europe warm? Well, the jury's still out on this one. It's still being debated by some scientists. Is it really the AMOC or the Gulf Stream that makes the UK and Europe warmer than their latitude would suggest? Almost everyone, including many top scientists, say yes, yes it is. But maybe not. This dispute is important because, if true, Northern Europe may not be so heavily impacted by an AMOC shutdown. So Richard Seeger is a climate scientist at Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. He was educated in the UK. He is a professor of ocean and climate physics at Columbia University. Seeger is definitely not a fringe climate denier. He's a real scientist. But Professor Seeger says the UK and North Europe are warmer than expected for their latitude, not because of the Gulf Stream or any ocean current. Here is his explanation, and I quote, "Using observations and climate models, we found that at the latitudes of Europe, the atmospheric heat transport exceeds that of the ocean by several fold. In winter, it may even be by an order of magnitude greater. Thus, it is the atmosphere, not the ocean, that does the lion's share of the work ameliorating winter climates in the extratropics. We also found that the seasonal absorption and release of heat by the ocean has a much larger impact on regional climates than does the movement of heat by ocean currents. Seasonal storage and release accounts for half the winter temperature difference across the North Atlantic Ocean, but the 500-pound gorilla in how regional climates are determined around the Atlantic turned out to be the Rocky Mountains. Because of the need to conserve angular momentum, as air flows from the west across the mountains, it is forced to first turn south and then to turn north further downstream. As such, the mountains force cold air south into eastern North America and warm air north into western Europe. This waviness in the flow is responsible for the other half of the temperature difference across the North Atlantic Ocean." End quote. Saying ocean transport contributes to small warming across the basin, Richard Seeger suggests a slowdown of the Gulf Stream would, quote, "introduce a modest cooling tendency." If true, that would be great news for our UK listeners, but it does not address really an increase in storminess and storm strength or the large drop in precipitation for European agriculture and other global impacts. Seeger has published several papers in support of his insistence that atmospheric changes dominate over ocean current influences like AMOC. He does not say the UK and North Europe will not cool, just not as much as predicted by ocean modelers. It shows the level of uncertainty about what will really happen when the AMOC goes into its off state. Personally, I think the OECD scientists were well aware of atmospheric science and probably took these factors raised by Seeger into account and still found dangerous cooling for Europe in the waters ahead. Final myth here, the AMOC operates alone. No, it doesn't. Scientists have tended to treat AMOC as a separate system of the ocean. I raised this with Suzanne Ditlefsen in our interview. We know AMOC is one end of a huge system of ocean water running from pole to pole. The Southern Ocean overturning circulation is the other end. As we learned in my April 2023 interview with Australia's Dr. Matthew England, the southern pump is failing too. He told us the surface to deep water exchange there has already tipped. As Western media gorged itself on Donald Trump news, climate activist Bill McKibben said this Southern Ocean change is the biggest story on the planet, and I agree. You can download my interview with lead author Dr. England free at ecoshock.org. We understand why some of the best European scientists, including in the UK, are working hard on what could happen to AMOC. They examine every influence, all the satellite data, every report from the past, whatever we can glean. But as Ditlefsen said, they do not appear to add in the weakened pump at the other end of the system, into Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. We need a whole world approach. Weakened overturning in the Southern Ocean could be an added significant reason why the AMOC has already dropped by at least 15%. How big a factor is it? Will that drive a state shift in AMOC even sooner? We all need to know. I hope to see published research on this question. Wrapping up, remember the AMOC collapsing by 2025 is a rare possibility, according to the authors of the study. It's at the bottom end of a 75-year bracket of possible timing. The date of this doom-like, huge-scale ocean shift is also determined by the rate humans continue to dump carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. A miracle of climate action might stall the AMOC shift by a century or two. Who knows? Maybe that would be enough time to find a solution. Personally, I don't see any signs of that miracle. We are going in reverse, funding new oil and gas and coal, burning more than ever while slashing down those forests. You all know the bad news. My guess, for what it is worth, anyone under the age of 40 has a good chance of being alive to witness the biggest shift since civilization began, and that is the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation will collapse into its alternate weak state. Then we enter the find-out phase. From what we can see dimly, we are producing a time of trials, dragging the rest of living things along with us. Next week on Radio EcoShock, something lighter, well, sort of, we revisit the eternal question, is it too late? This 2009 radio special of mine is called Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think. It has clips from James Lovelock, Derek Jensen, James Hansen, and many more, and it includes a few tunes. Listen in. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for hanging out in this changing current and caring about our world.
You work and work for years and years. You're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough.
Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
So it's going to be doomer stuff getting more doomer next week with Alex Smith next Wednesday. Ry Cooder, he popularized from Cuba the Buena Vista Social Club. Here he is with the Chief.
Divina la ilusión que me trajiste para sentirte tuya, tuya tú como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Yo siento tus amarras como garfios, como garras que se ahogan en la playa de la farra y el dolor. Y siento tus amarras arrastrar en mi noche callada, que sea plenilunada, azul como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna.
ya no vuelves nunca, provincianita mía, a mi selva querida, que está triste y está sola. Al menos tu recuerdo ponga luz sobre mi bruma, pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna.
Buena Vista Social Club from Cuba. Now Maria Gilardin's Time of Useful Consciousness. With Daniel Ellsberg.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dismantle the doomsday machine. Abolish nuclear weapons. Daniel Ellsberg at the gates of Lawrence Livermore Lab. There are two locations where all U.S. nuclear weapons are designed. Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California is one of them. Since 1983, Tri-Valley Cares has monitored nuclear weapons and environmental cleanup throughout the U.S., with a special focus on Livermore Lab. Every year on August 6, Tri-Valley Cares and supporters gather at the gates of Livermore Lab to remember the victims of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This year, 2023, the silent vigil was also dedicated to Daniel Ellsberg. He had been at the gates of Livermore Lab many times in the past and gotten arrested for blocking the entrance. He died in June of this year at age 93. Ellsberg had released the Pentagon Papers to hasten an end to the war in Vietnam. He was an analyst at the RAND Corporation and a consultant on nuclear warfare to the U.S. Defense Department. Ever since his experience with nuclear war planning, Ellsberg demanded dismantlement of what he termed the doomsday machine. Enchanted Films showed a movie with Daniel Ellsberg at the August 2023 vigil at Livermore Lab. They assembled many profound and fact-filled speeches Ellsberg had given at the gates of Livermore Lab, including two recent ones on Zoom, when COVID made being there in person too risky. Here's Daniel Ellsberg in 2020 and 2021.
Hi, I'm Dan Ellsberg. I was 14 when the bomb exploded over Hiroshima. I'm 89 now. 75 years have gone by. And it's time, I think, beyond time, to reflect on something that Mahatma Gandhi posed 75 years ago, a few weeks after Hiroshima. He described the event as having set him into silence, almost paralysis for some time, thinking it was the most diabolical use of science there had ever been, and it was a sign that the world must adopt nonviolence or would face certain suicide. So far, it has not meant suicide for humanity. But he raised the question in his form, what this has done to the soul of a destroying nation is yet too early to see. Well, 75 years have gone by, and that question has hardly been addressed, and I would say it's not too early to look for an answer to that right now. First of all, what's missing in most discussions of this decision-making and what's followed it is the fact that the use of the bomb against civilians, killing 100,000 or so, women and children mainly, with the men mostly being away at war at that time in Hiroshima, was for the American people a shocking revelation that we seem to have changed the millennia-old proscription against deliberate, indiscriminate targeting of non-combatants, and that we had destroyed a city of non-combatants in a flash. That was a startling revelation to many people, but not to the people inside the government, who were aware that they had crossed that barrier years earlier. First, in imitation of Hitler and the Blitz over London, and even earlier, the Japanese and the bombing of Guernica in Spain. The British had adopted nighttime firebombing of cities in Germany because it was too costly for them to face anti-aircraft and fighter pilots in the daytime. Our bombers' pilots at first described that as baby killing and eschewed it in favor supposedly of high altitude bombing of military targets and bases, but found that that was ineffective, and we turned to the British or Nazi method of firebombing by 1944, almost entirely in Japan. Specifically, on the night of March 9th, 10th, 1945, General Curtis from ACE sent some 300 bombers over Tokyo and killed between 80 and 120,000 civilians, burned to death in one night. The largest act of terrorism, the deliberate killing of non-combatants for a political purpose in history, and more than was killed in either Hiroshima or Nagasaki or almost altogether. And in fact, our Air Force under LeMay had been doing that as much as they could to other cities, over 64, perhaps 100 cities in Japan, night after night, almost every other day, killing between several hundred thousand and 900,000 Japanese civilians before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So Hiroshima did not represent a change in, let's say, the souls of the people sending those bombers over. When we say soul, I think we're talking about essence, morality, spirit of a person or a nation. And the Americans were confronted now with the fact that they, I don't think they did realize they had been lied to about our seeking exclusively military targets up till that time. But the issue was now raised. Was this justified? And in answer to that, former Secretary of War Stimson, in an article drafted by McGeorge Bundy, later assistant to John F. Kennedy, and largely set in its framework by James Conant, the president of Harvard, who had been in charge of the atomic bomb program, gave an explanation which was essentially false. Peter Kuznick and many other historians have made it clear now that the explanation given to the American public was false, that the bomb had been actually a savior of lives, that there was no other way to achieve a surrender on our terms, and we were ready to allow the emperor to remain, which was the basic term asked for by the Japanese emperor and his subordinates, had been available actually for some months before that, and that the entry of the Soviet Union, which was scheduled for August 14th at least, and took place on August 8th after the first atom bomb, was certain to cause the Japanese to turn to us with that proposal immediately, and we would accept it, so that the war could have been ended, possibly, and actually from the Japanese point of view, very probably, before August of 1944, had they chosen to do that. But there was a desire to use the bombs before the Soviet entry, or with it, and to end the war with that rather than earlier, so that the demonstration of our willingness to use this bomb ruthlessly and discriminately would be a warning to the Soviets, perhaps roll them back in East Europe, which they were then occupying. It had no chance of doing that, and it failed to do that, nor did we achieve the monopoly of the bomb that, again, Truman and Groves, in charge of the project, delusionally believed was available to us, a delusion which kept them from any real interest in renouncing use of the bomb or seeking genuine international control that would prevent us from using it. So since that time, we have never rejected first use of that bomb on the president's judgment, not only to deter Soviet or other attack, which wasn't even possible before 1949, but to establish an effective protectorate over the European nations and others, Japan and others, which would give a strong alliance and economic relationships that would be profitable, influential in a variety of ways. The Russians imitated that buildup in the mid-60s. Now, a number of scientists at the time who knew about the bomb from the beginning advised in May and June of 1945, before the test of the bomb in July, that to test it, let alone to use it without warning against an enemy that the Soviets knew was approaching surrender, which wanted surrender anyway, would assure that there was no possibility of international control or of preventing the Russians, inducing the Russians in any way to refrain from imitating our testing. which they did with the help of spies, actually, at the beginning. They actually first tested a direct blueprint of our bomb, which they'd gotten from Klaus Fuchs. But on their own, they proceeded, as our scientists had predicted, within a few years, to match our technical achievement. And within 10 years, had done what the scientists also predicted, produce an H-bomb, a thermonuclear bomb, 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki. In fact, a fusion bomb, an H-bomb, which required a Nagasaki bomb as its trigger. And at the height of the arms race which ensued, as predicted by the scientists, the world saw 70,000 nuclear weapons in existence in the U.S. and Russia, most of them thermonuclear weapons. That means that there have been, since for more than half a century, two doomsday machines, which I describe them as such, because each of them, if carrying out its plans against the other adversary, even against military targets in and around cities, would cause firestorms, like the one we produced in Tokyo, that would loft smoke into the stratosphere where it would not rain out, go around the world, reduce sunlight by 70%, and kill most vegetation and harvests, all harvests, essentially for as much as a decade, dooming almost all of humanity in the entire globe to starvation, near extinction. And moreover, both of these doomsday machines are on hair trigger alert, in the sense that to protect their international continental ballistics, which are each vulnerable to attack by the other, from being attacked on the ground, in the event of either warning, of radar warning, which has often been false, or of strategic warning in the form of some armed conflict between the U.S. and Russia, which has not yet ever occurred, but which would be expected to lead before long to escalate both to nuclear war and to all-out nuclear war. And again, in those circumstances, each side is prepared to launch its forces against another in another delusional belief that going first surely is better than going second, no matter how bad it is. That is false. Since the discovery of nuclear winter 35 years ago, it won't make any difference. But it is profitable on both sides to imagine that it will make a difference, because that leads to the production of weapons that provide jobs, votes, and profits on both sides, and to warn the other that the other must be very careful not to provoke such an attack. The thing we learned from Hiroshima was that since the attack had saved American lives, supposedly, and had been judged against alternatives and reflectively and analytically and with great success, that we could trust the judgment of our political leaders to decide when and how to use them. And that basic trust, which was never justified, was because there were many reasons for doing this at the time, none of them adding up to an adequate justification for taking on the production eventually of these doomsday machines. This is not a species to be trusted with nuclear weapons. There has never been a leader of Russia or a leader of the U.S. or the other nuclear countries whose judgment should be trusted to preserve prudently and safely this standoff between doomsday machines that may go off at any crisis in particular, any false alarm, any kind of armed conflict of the kind that still is contemplated and against which both sides have warned and promised and ready themselves to initiate nuclear war. In short, what has happened to the soul of the destroying countries and to the others that have now imitated it does portend not the certain doom of humanity in any particular time, but a constant risk of most humans on Earth and many other species disappearing within a matter of months or years at the judgment of leaders such as Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin or the others. This has been accepted wrongly for very long. That has defined, in a way, our existing spirit and morale and morality, that must change if we care as a species for prolonging this experiment of life on Earth, human life on Earth. We must reverse this process, and by protest and legal means and constitutional means, every other, to take this out of the hands of the leaders that have put us in this position at last, and act for our species' survival. Thank you.
Here's Daniel Ellsberg in 2021.
You should wear a coat and tie when getting arrested. For the last 2 years, you and I have typically gotten arrested either on Hiroshima Day or Nagasaki Day. What is the point of that? In part, it's because I say I would like people to see that possessing a coat and tie does not excuse you from the obligations of citizenship. And in situations like today, or in the context we are protesting and condemning, those obligations include sending as strong a message as we can that business as usual is not appropriate, that we're in an emergency, and that that emergency has a moral dimension, and that we are willing to spend not just a few hours or a day, but for most of us, a significant part of our lives, trying to warn our fellow citizens that there is an obligation to stop business as usual at Livermore and Los Alamos, in the Pentagon in general, in terms of nuclear weapons, just as Greta Thunberg, calling for a general strike on Fridays, was conveying the message that we are in an emergency with respect to climate that calls for people acting out of the ordinary and calling on others to do the same. Can it possibly work? I know it can, because I felt that pressure on my own life. It changed my life. If it were not for young Americans who were willing to go to prison to make the strongest message they could that this war, Vietnam War, should not be participated in, that it was wrong, that message got through to me and changed my life and raised the question in my mind, what could I do to help shorten this war back 50 years ago? Now that I'm ready to go to prison like these others, following their example. But the most general message that needed to be conveyed was, if people are willing to risk the good reputation of their team, of their boss, if they're willing to risk their careers, their clearances, their access, could they not do more to warn their fellow citizens and move them to action than when they don't take that risk? I needed that example, certainly, of moral courage, the willingness to risk ostracism, like my other fellows in government, because we'd simply never asked ourselves the question whether it might be our duty to resist the president and his policies. After all, we had virtually all signed on to be president's men. In those days, it was almost entirely male. Now there's a few women involved. To be loyal, to be faithful, reliable, obedient in doing whatever he wanted, including, and again, the president up till now has only been male, but it would be the same with a female president who was wrongly keeping secrets about a policy that was heading us toward disaster. After all, we're following, you and I who do this, the teaching of Henry David Thoreau, whose essay in 1849, 172 years ago, was first entitled Resistance to Civil Government, and then later published on the title The Duty of Civil Disobedience, or sometimes just called An Essay on Civil Disobedience. The idea that it might be our obligation to break a promise of paying taxes or keeping secrets or passively going along with what was then happening, actually, a war against Mexico, which he rightly described as an imperial war, an aggressive war, absolutely a war of aggrandizement on the order of European monarchies. That last description is actually a little closer to, of all people, President Ulysses S. Grant, who in his memoirs described the Mexican War in which he'd participated in exactly those terms, and said that he regretted intensely that he had lacked, quote, the moral courage to refuse his orders to participate. participating in that war, to provoking a war with Mexico and carrying it through when he was an officer in the army. And he said that it was crucial, that one, to bringing on the civil war later. The other evil that Thoreau was protesting by going to jail, and against his wishes, he was bailed out very quickly by a relative. He preferred to stay in and go to trial if that had been possible. But the other was slavery. And as Lincoln put it, if slavery is not wrong, then nothing is wrong. We are saying that is true of the doomsday machines which exist in the United States and smaller ones in seven other states, 30 nations accepting the protection, supposedly, of threats of initiating nuclear war to defend them. In other words, prolonging our protectorate at the cost of making that protectorate credible by building systems that can destroy most human life on Earth as a result of nuclear winter. In the early 80s, President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev agreed and stated, nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. And that has been reiterated just recently in this presidential term by Putin and Biden, both, each of which is still involved, as were Reagan and Gorbachev when they said that, in building up our first strike, our first use capabilities for disarming the opponent in various cases. In other words, saying that the nuclear war could not be won did not slow up the arms race at all or reduce the risks of nuclear war, which I would say persist as before, not less than before, the last 50 years of the nuclear arms race. The number of weapons on the U.S. and Russian side have been reduced by over 80%, and that has had no effect on the risk of a war based on a false alarm, on which we launched on warning, are the ICBMs on either side. It hasn't resulted in getting rid of those ICBMs, which are not just anachronistic, but extremely dangerous as hair triggers to the doomsday machine. How is it then that that assertion is not reflected at all in our policies? Well, they didn't say and didn't believe a nuclear war must not be threatened as a basis for alliances or for a protectorate over others, in the U.S. case in particular. Actually, the Chinese have asserted the ability in various contexts of initiating nuclear war in relation to Taiwan, which they regard not as an other nation, but as a province of their own nation. And our commitment, in the words of Biden and Trump and others, to defend Taiwan, the independence of Taiwan, against any military attack from China, puts us on a collision course with China that could, in fact, lead to partial or total nuclear winter. I did not risk life in prison, which I was charged with, a possible 115 years, nor did any one of the 5,000 who actually did go to prison in this country do that because we thought the war was not winnable. And if we thought it was winnable, they wouldn't have done that. That's not the case for any one of them. They and I did it because we understood that the war was wrong. It was as wrong as slavery was wrong. If these are not wrongs, if the existence of a doomsday machine is not wrong, as Lincoln put it, then nothing is wrong. And it is wrong. So this willingness then to defy the popularly supported movement toward preparation for nuclear war, risk of it in ways that could be terminated and reduced, threats of it, which persist on both sides actually now more than before, but have always existed for the U.S., that this was wrong, never justified. How about then the threats to do it? That has maintained a real threat, a real risk, a danger from year to year of our destroying most life on Earth. We as a species are on the Titanic. or as Nikita Khrushchev called it during the Cuban Missile Crisis, our arc. And what is at stake is not just mutual destruction, let's say, of the U.S. and Russia, horrific as that would be, but the annihilation of most of the species, neutrals, people in the southern hemisphere who had nothing to do with this, whether it's near extinction or less than that, a totally wicked gamble. What is called for now is what was called for on the Titanic that night, mutiny by the second in command, who knew what they were doing, knew the risks they were taking, didn't jeopardize his job, or for that matter, the captain, who wasn't actually ordered to move ahead, but knew that's what his bosses wanted, and that his own career depended on that. So he took a gamble which our presidents and the Russians, and to a somewhat lesser degree, all of the other nuclear states, are making hostages of the lives of most people on Earth. That is wrong, and it should be mutinied, and we can continue to do what you and I have been doing for years here, and more than that, as I say, not just going to jail on the anniversary of those two acts of mass murder, of second-degree murder, which could be called depraved indifference murder, which is a legal category, meaning not an intention deliberately to kill any one person, but taking risks of doing that to many people, which are unconscionable, which indicate an absolute lack of concern for others, quote, others, not us, them, enemies, and even neutrals. People I'm speaking to, I know very well from having been in jail on various occasions with them, for having risked arrest, for doing what we can to turn this ship around, know well that nothing less than that is called for. So thank you for what you've done in the past and what you will do in the future. It gives us a chance.
That was Daniel Ellsberg's 2021 message for the vigil on Hiroshima Day at the gates of Livermore Lab in California, where nuclear weapons are being designed. Ellsberg, best known for the release of the Pentagon Papers, also was a consultant to the U.S. Defense Department. His acclaimed autobiography is titled Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Thanks to Tri-Valley Cares and Enchanted Films for recording and preserving the voice of their friend and supporter, Daniel Ellsberg, and sharing with me on TUC. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
You're the son of a thousand fathers, all like you. And your mother...
Your mother? She's... Your mother! I spit it out to talk of her! I never heard anybody!
Wanted in 14 counties of this state, condemned to sound guilty of the crimes of murder, armed robbery of citizens, state banks, and post offices, the theft of sacred objects, arson in a state prison, perjury, bigamy, deserting his wife and children, citing prostitution, kidnapping, extortion, receiving stolen goods, selling stolen goods, passing counterfeit money, and contrary to the laws of this state, the condemned is guilty of using marked cards and loaded knives. Therefore, according to the powers vested in us, we sentence the accused for us? Tuco Benedicto Pacifico Juan Maria Ramirez?
Known as the Rat.
And any other aliases you might... Hang by the neck until dead. May God have mercy on his soul. Proceed.
Whenever the laws of any state are broken, a duly authorized organization swings into action. It may be called the state police, state troopers, militia, the rangers, or...
Radio Free Kansas.
These are the stories of the men whose training, skill, and courage have enforced and preserved our state laws.
Calling all coordinates, calling all coordinates.
Moon 4 degrees Taurus.
Roger. Transfer rising. Roger. 29, 5-59. Roger.
This one looks serious, Roger.
You're right. We'd better call Captain Equinox.
Captain Equinox, the deadliest foe of those who attest our ailing democracy. By day, Adolf Tree, a mild-mannered college professor. By night, Kiki, a mini-skirted habitué of Hollywood starstruck sunset strip. But twice a year, he's
Captain Equinox.
Today's dumb story spies over Broadway, but first here's Captain Equinox himself with today's secret coded message.
Okay, Solstice Squad, get your pencil and paper ready and listen up. You can buy a car, rent a car, or have your car serviced at Jack Poet Volkswagen in Highland Park at 5944 North Figueroa off the Avenue 60 exit of the Pasadena Freeway. Got that down?
If you don't have your decoder, tear off the top of your daddy's car and mail it, together with 10 cents in cash or coin, to Captain Equinox Decoder Tie, Drop City, Colorado. And now...
Captain Equinox!
1 foot fighter 22, 1 foot fighter 22.
Him?
Come in, please.
Who's him? A nobody.
1 foot fighter 22, 1 foot fighter 22.
Just a cop.
Come in, please.
His name's Kulzip. Checked with Lieutenant Random, Kulzip, XPD, and he's been on the force so long he looks like a 57-year-old potato in a trick suit.
1 foot fighter 22. One housewife 45, one housewife 45. This is one daddy, 57.
He's forgotten at home, and he runs his siren just for company, but he's a crumpled kind of hero to his wife.
This is one housewife 45, reading you, dear. Reading you, sir. Reading you, one daddy, 57.
Where in hell's 1 foot fighter 22?
Locating. I have a 36 via location.
Okay, okay. Hook it up.
I am hooking.
What is she saying? He's a tough guy with television dreams who's in a fight to keep this street quiet. His street.
This 1 foot fighter 22. One foot fighter 22.
This is one daddy 57. Where the hell are you? State your position.
Position is vertical. Position of chopper horizontal. I have a suspect of obelisk at corner of police and eat the streets.